mean, I really want you to picture a scenario that I am, well, I'm almost certain you've lived through at least once.
Oh, I think I know where this is going.
Right. So you're at this massive family gathering. It's, maybe a summer reunion or a wedding, and the plates have just been cleared.
Yep, the dangerous post-dinner lull.
Exactly. And someone, it's usually like an overly enthusiastic aunt or uncle, decides that this is the absolute perfect moment for a group portrait.
Oh no, it's always a terrible idea.
It is. So you suddenly find yourself trying to coordinate 12 different people. You've got grandparents who just want to sit down.
Toddlers who are actively trying to run away.
Yes, and like teenagers looking at their phones. And you are desperately trying to get a dozen completely independent humans to just stand still.
Which is basically impossible.
It's like herding 12 cats into a cardboard box. You want them to look at the exact same little camera lens and, project a natural smile at the exact same millisecond.
Right. It is an absolute logistical nightmare. You are essentially fighting against human nature and physics at the exact same time.
Completely. And you know how it ends, right? Like, you look at the photo a week later and it's just captured
Half
chaos.
the group is blinking.
Exactly. Someone is staring off at a bird, and like three people are wearing those incredibly strained, awkward smiles because they had to hold them for 30 seconds straight.
It's true. Achieving any kind of genuine cohesive harmony in a family portrait of that scale just feels mathematically impossible.
It really does. You usually just end up with this, well, this visual roster of who is there rather than actually capturing who that family is.
Which is precisely what makes our mission for today's deep dive so incredibly compelling.
Totally.
Because we are looking at a monumental challenge here, both in terms of visual art and emotional heavy lifting.
Yeah.
We're exploring how contemporary art can actually intersect with family memory and identity and the preservation of a legacy.
And doing it in a way that completely avoids that chaotic, awkward, school yearbook dynamic
Yeah,
entirely.
exactly.
So to navigate this, we are diving into the world of contemporary artist Jairo Duque. And we've got two incredibly rich sources to pull from today.
We really do.
Yeah. First, we're looking at his official digital ecosystem, which is artcoloragua.com.
Right.
And second, we're zooming in on a very specific section. I mean, specifically pages 437 to 439 of his deeply reflective book, Trestio.
Such a fascinating book.
It really is. And so our objective today is unpack how he manages to capture the true essence of a 12-person family.
The Caicedo Gaviria family.
Yes, the Caicedo Gaviria family. And we want to see how this particular series of paintings actually functions as a really powerful symbolic archive for their descendants.
But before we can truly appreciate the emotional weight of these 12 portraits, we kind of have to understand the architecture of the mind that created them.
Oh, absolutely.
Because when you visit Duth's website, you are not looking at just a standard minimalist portfolio.
Right. It's not just a place where an artist posts a few high-resolution JPEGs of their paintings, slaps on a bio, and calls it a day.
Not even close.
I mean, browsing his digital archive is this highly specific, almost intimidating experience.
Intimidating is a good word for it.
Yeah, if I had to describe it, it feels like walking into the physical studio of a master craftsman who, well, who happens to have a touch of obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right, like everything has its place.
Exactly. Every single brush, every sketch, every carving tool has its own perfectly labeled, custom-built drawer.
The digital footprint is just massive. And as you said, it is brutally categorized. It's a complete
It
ecosystem.
really is.
He breaks his life's work down into highly specific thematic sections, like social protest, nature, urban painting.
Right?
And then he cross-categorizes by medium, drawing these strict boundaries between his oil work, his acrylics, his watercolors, and his digital art.
It's so structured.
He even includes a really robust behind-the-work section featuring his personal sketchbooks and technical resources meant for other artists to use.
Which honestly tells us so much about his psychology.
Yeah, it does.
Like, for him, the underlying system and the mechanical process are just as vital as the final image that ends up hanging on a wall.
He's a thinker who relies on structures, definitely.
And when you think about it, that hyperstructural mindset is probably the only way you can approach something as sprawling and messy and potentially chaotic as a 12-person family history.
Right, because you need a framework or you just get lost in the noise of it all.
Exactly.
And that framework is explicitly clear in his book, Trastio, which actually has its own dedicated central category within this massive website.
It's a huge part of his work.
Yeah. And Trastio isn't just, you know, a glossy coffee table book full of pretty pictures. It is a deeply narrative, structural project divided into personal anecdotes, contextual history, and these philosophical reflections.
So we're starting with this macro-level, highly organized digital universe, right?
Right.
But the sources push us to zoom all the way in. We're moving from this vast digital ecosystem down to the really intimate physical reality of the Trastio book.
Down to the canvas.
Exactly. Specifically, to 12 individual portraits of the Caicedo Gaviria family.
And the physical reality of these portraits is where the intentionality of the artist really shines.
Oh, for sure.
Because we're looking at 12 distinct pieces, and they're painted in acrylic.
Right.
Specifically, he uses the Liquitex brand, which is known for its really heavy body and fast drying time.
Okay, wait, keep that in mind because that detail becomes really important later when we discuss his actual technique.
It absolutely does. But the other thing is, these canvases are small. Yeah. Like, they are only 9 by 12 inches each.
Which is, I mean, that's basically the size of a standard piece of notebook paper.
Exactly.
Totally forces intimacy. Yeah. You cannot view a 9 by 12 inch painting from across a massive museum gallery.
No, you'd miss all the detail.
Right. You literally have to walk up to it. You have to stand a foot away to really see it.
Yep. And they're based on a series of photographs he took during a visit to Whittier, California, back in November of 2016.
Okay.
But the most striking thing to me about these 12 intimate canvases is how they're arranged and presented within the text.
Oh, the layout.
Yeah, there is an absolute deliberate absence of visual hierarchy.
Right, because when you look at classic historical family portraits, there is almost always a power dynamic at play, isn't there?
Always.
Like the patriarch is usually seated right in the center, maybe in this massive velvet chair, just completely dominating the composition.
Usually with a literal spotlight hitting his face.
Yes, while the children and the extended family are just sort of clustered around the edges in the shadows like supporting characters.
Well, Duke rejects that entirely. The 12 members of the Caicedo Gaviria family are presented sequentially, just flowing left to right, top to bottom.
It's like a flat democratic grid.
Exactly. We see Limbania, Martiligia, Elcias, Maria Victoria, Gerardo, Maritza Alejandra, and then the father, Don Elcias, the mother, Doña Rubiela.
Right, just mixed in.
Followed by Maria Jacoba Ortiz, Maria Fernanda, Maria Clemencia, and Ruby Encarnacion.
So every single person gets exactly the same 9 by 12 inch slice of visual real estate.
Mm.
No one is pushed to the background.
It's a profound statement of equality. I think Duke understands a fundamental limitation of art here, which is that you cannot paint an entire life story.
No, of course not.
To capture the full historical and emotional reality of 12 different human beings, a single canvas is useless. You would need an entire encyclopedic library.
Right.
So instead of trying to paint their entire biographies, he approaches the visual chaos of 12 distinct faces conceptually. He treats these 12 individual portraits as a musical chorus.
Okay, I want to pause on that musical analogy for a second.
Sure.
Because it's a really interesting concept. But in practice, I'm not sure it holds up without some serious heavy lifting from the family itself.
How do you mean?
Well, if you think about a chorus, say you have 12 incredibly strong, distinct voices, right? You have your sopranos, your tenors, your basses, and by themselves, they're distinct and beautiful.
Right.
But if they're all just singing whatever they want, you know, trying to be the loudest voice in the room, you do not get a unified emotional tone. You just get an unbearable cacophony.
That's true.
In a massive family, if everyone is just projecting their own personality without some kind of guiding force, you just get a shouting match over the dinner table.
Like herding cats again.
Exactly. So my question is, who is keeping them in tune? Who is the conductor?
And that is the critical question the source material forces us to ask, because a chorus cannot exist without a conductor.
Right.
But in the case of the Caicedo Gaviria family, the conductor isn't just a single authoritarian figure waving a baton around. It's actually a dual leadership model.
Okay, a dual model.
The texts describe this family as being guided by a shared moral architecture, which was meticulously constructed by the parents.
Okay, let's examine the foundational pillars of that moral architecture, starting with the father, Don Elcias.
So, Don Elcias is the undisputed moral pillar of this clan. But the most fascinating aspect of his leadership, and I think this speaks volumes about the mechanics of family memory, is that Don Alcides passed away more than 2 decades before these portraits were even conceptualized.
Wait, really? He's been gone for over 20 years, and his presence is still dictating the tone of the chorus.
Yes. His influence completely transcends physical time. The texts note that his moral foundation survives through the family's shared, relentless work ethic.
Wow.
But it's even more granular than that. His memory lives on in the very vocabulary of the family.
Like the way they speak.
Exactly. The specific proverbs, the idioms, the little sayings that he used to use are still being repeated by his descendants today.
I love that.
He essentially wrote the sheet music that the family is still singing from.
That makes perfect sense for establishing the underlying values. But,
yeah.
You know, values are kind of abstract. Like if the father provided the moral blueprint, someone still has to actually build the house. Someone has to manage the daily friction of a dozen people living and breathing and inevitably clashing in a shared space.
And that brings us to the mother, Doña Rubiela.
Yes.
Doña Rubiela took charge of the care, the connection, and the actual expansion of the family. And the author uses this stunningly specific phrase to describe her role.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
He defines her leadership as an effective chancellery.
I mean, I had to read that phrase 3 times when I saw it in the notes because it is just brilliant. Effective chancellery.
Just so good.
Because normally when we talk about a strong mother figure in a large family, we use domestic terms, right?
Okay.
We call her the matriarch or the glue that holds everyone together or maybe the peacemaker.
Right. Very standard terms.
But chancellery, that shifts the entire context. It implies an actual diplomatic corps.
It elevates the emotional labor of a mother to the level of international statecraft.
Exactly. It suggests she wasn't just, you know, sitting there baking pies. She was actively engaging in high-stakes diplomacy at the dining room table.
Which is necessary with 12 people.
Right. I'm picturing this 12-person family where 2 siblings are feuding, an uncle feels slighted, a cousin needs money.
A standard Tuesday.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And this effective diplomatic leader, this chancellor, is mediating those disputes. She's negotiating truces, building strategic alliances between different sub-factions of the family, and actively preventing outright wars to maintain the unity of the clan.
And crucially, the text explicitly clarifies that this chancellery was not an Ordino y Mando. It was not a dictatorship of command and control.
Okay, so she wasn't just ruling with an iron fist.
Not at all. She didn't just slam her hand on the table and demand obedience. She led through constant diplomatic care. She fostered their professional formation, guiding their education and careers with a soft but undeniable power.
Which is just incredible. And that gives us the context for why Shiro Duque felt compelled to undertake this massive project in the first place, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
Because this specific family, operating under the father's moral blueprint and the mother's masterful, effective chancellery, actually provided physical shelter to the artist.
Yes, and profound solidarity to Duque and his own family.
Right, in their historic home in the San Bosco neighborhood of Cali.
San Bosco is this very traditional, historic neighborhood, and that physical house just became a sanctuary for him.
Wow.
So because of the shelter they provided, Duque created this 12-part series as what he calls a minimum act of symbolic justice.
A minimum act? That's heavy.
He felt he owed them this. The artwork is designed to function as a symbolic archive for future generations. It's specifically aimed at the grandchildren.
Which is such a beautiful way of ensuring that the emotional weight of that house in San Bosco and the massive diplomatic legacy of Doña Rubiela doesn't just evaporate when the older generation passes away.
Exactly. It anchors their identity in something tangible.
However, this brings up a really fascinating contradiction in how the artist actually executed the work.
Oh, the technique.
Yeah. Because we've established that Duque holds a deep, profound reverence for this family's moral foundation and this mother's diplomatic genius.
Right? Deep reverence, yes.
And logically, if you were creating a permanent historical archive to honor people who literally put a roof over your head, you would expect the artwork to reflect that reverence in its style.
You'd expect realism.
Exactly. You would expect something classical, pristine, and perfectly polished, almost like royalty. You'd want them to look flawless.
But he does the exact opposite. He intentionally employs a highly experimental, deliberately fragmented, and almost an abrasive technique.
We really need to break down the mechanics of this because it's not just a standard painting process.
Mm-hmm.
The physical method he uses is incredibly unconventional.
It really is. He utilizes a specific image transfer technique. To understand this, you kind of have to picture the physical act.
Okay, walk me through it.
So he takes a printed photograph, likely a laser print, where the toner sits on the surface of the paper.
Right.
He applies a thick acrylic binder, basically a wet, sticky medium, directly to the canvas, and then he just presses the photograph face down into it.
So he is essentially gluing the photo face down onto the 9x12 canvas.
Yes, but that is just the first step.
Okay.
Once that acrylic binder completely dries and hardens, which traps the ink of the photograph, he takes a wet sponge and painstakingly rubs the back of the paper away.
Right, rubs it away.
Yeah, he destroys the paper, rolling off these little wet fibers until nothing is left but the raw, transferred ink silhouette, physically trapped in the dried acrylic.
That sounds incredibly delicate, but also kind of violent.
Yeah.
Like you are literally scrubbing away the physical photograph to leave behind a ghost of the image.
Precisely. And once he has that raw silhouette, that's when he begins to paint over it with his heavy body Liquitex acrylics.
The ones we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. But he intentionally avoids blending. He completely refuses to create fine finishes or smooth gradients on the skin.
But why? I mean, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
If I hired an artist to paint a portrait of my beloved grandmother, and he handed me something that looked scrubbed, unblended, and rough, I might be a little taken aback.
I get that.
Because the result sounds almost dirty. It resembles a pixelated photograph where you can see the raw vibration and the aggressive physical gesture of every single brushstroke.
Yeah.
Isn't it a massive risk to portray respected elders in such an unpolished way?
On the surface, it absolutely seems contradictory, but there is a profound emotional logic at work here.
Okay.
The artist could take this radical, unpolished risk precisely because he knew their features and their souls so intimately.
I see.
When you truly deeply know a family, when you've lived under their roof and experienced their effective chancellery firsthand, you realize that human beings are not flawless, smooth, classical statues.
No, they're complicated. They have friction.
Exactly. He didn't need photorealistic detail to capture their essence. A few raw, fragmented, energetic strokes were enough for him to synthesize their core identity.
That's powerful.
He didn't need to paint every single eyelash perfectly. He needed to capture the vibration of their presence in a room.
Right.
Furthermore, this specific experimental technique acts as what the source text calls a conceptual seal.
Okay, what does that mean in this context, a conceptual seal?
Think back to the very beginning of our conversation when we discussed his massive, brutally categorized digital website.
All the drawers.
Yes. Out of all his vast categorized works, out of all the different mediums he has mastered, and out of the entire thick volume of the Trastio book, this specific fragmented image transfer technique is completely exclusive to these 12 portraits.
That is fascinating. So, out of his entire life's work, this specific aesthetic language only exists for the Caicedo Gaviria family.
Yes.
It's a singular, exclusive visual language developed for a singular, unique group of people.
Exactly. The raw, unpolished nature of the paint is not a lack of care or a lack of skill. It's proof of ultimate intimacy.
I love that.
The fragmented brushstrokes are meant to mirror the complex, layered, sometimes messy reality of human beings who are bound together by a moral architecture.
It really is a remarkable journey when you step back and look at the trajectory of the sources today.
It really is.
Because we started by navigating the highly structured, almost clinical, perfectly organized digital universe of Jairo Duke's website.
Right.
And from those neat, infinitely expandable digital drawers, we were forced to zoom all the way down into the highly intimate, restricted physical space of 12 small, 9x12-inch canvases.
And in making that transition, we uncovered how a deliberately fragmented, physically abrasive painting technique can actually honor a profound family legacy far better than perfect realism.
Totally.
We saw how a physical archive can capture a father's enduring moral foundation and permanently immortalize a mother's incredible dining room diplomacy.
Her effective chancellery.
Yes. Preserved not in flawless, smooth detail, but in the raw, authentic vibration of the brushstroke.
You know, spending time with these sources really forces you to reevaluate how we capture and interact with our own family memories today.
Oh, absolutely. It's completely different now.
Because our modern reality is the exact opposite of what Jairo Duke did. I mean, right now, if you pull out your smartphone, you probably have a camera roll containing thousands, maybe tens of thousands, of perfectly sharp, perfectly lit, high-resolution digital photographs of your family.
Oh, yeah. You probably have 30 burst photos of the exact same moment at Thanksgiving dinner.
We live in an era of infinite storage and flawless megapixels. We capture everything perfectly.
We do. But how many of those flawless, perfect digital files are just floating in a cloud server, completely forgotten?
That's the thing. We capture every second of our lives in stunning detail, but we rarely ever look at them.
They're just data.
Right. The images are perfect, but they lack weight.
Yeah.
Yet here we have a physically painted, deliberately imperfect, almost pixelated and fragmented portrait series that possesses so much more power.
It demands to be looked at.
Yeah, it really does. It captures the true human density and the complex soul of a family in a way that 1,000 perfect forgotten digital photos never could.
It reminds us that preserving a family's legacy isn't about capturing perfect visual data. It's about capturing the emotional truth of who they were to each other.
Which leaves us with a rather provocative question to mull over long after we wrap up today.
Let's hear it.
Does our modern obsession with flawless digital storage actually cause us to lose our emotional memory?
Ooh, that's a good one.
I mean, when you think back to that chaotic family photo scenario we started, with the one where everyone is blinking, looking away, and acting like cats in a cardboard box, maybe the goal isn't to force the perfect harmonious shot.
Probably not.
Maybe the real challenge is figuring out how you are choosing to actively preserve the effective chancellery of your own family in a world that is completely overflowing with forgotten digital perfection.
It is definitely something to think about the next time you point a camera at the people you love.
It really is. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we look forward to exploring our next stack of sources with you.